groceries, which is a really strange term to use, I have to tell you. All of those stories and more on today's bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com. Get the newest children's book, Think Like a Voter, at davidpacman.com/book. I'll see you in moments on the bonus. Well, happy Eclipse Day, everybody. You know, there is no opportunity that is not going to be brazenly taken advantage of by a certain wing of the political spectrum with conspiracy theories and fear-mongering, and if they can, the blaming of someone on the left for sure. And we have an example of that with the eclipse. We are going to look not only at Rudy Giuliani, but also at video of Marjorie Taylor Greene's boyfriend, Brian Glenn, who is also an anchor. Excuse me, I almost choked on his name. On the right wing, Right Side Broadcasting Network. He is saying, look, you've got this rare eclipse. We had an earthquake in New York City. There's locusts, by which I guess he means the cicadas. I don't know. And it's all very suspicious, and it could be sort of apocalyptic. And that's the context we have to understand this in. This is always a sort of overt or implicit alluding to apocalyptic, rapture, Christian type, fire and brimstone sort of stuff. And here is Brian Glenn from his car levying a warning. There is nothing they won't try to take advantage of and or end up being confused by.
I want you guys to have a fantastic weekend, and here's why. This might be the last normal weekend that we have for quite some time. I mean, we've got this solar eclipse on Monday, this very rare solar eclipse. Who knows what the fallout from that will be?
I don't think there's going to be any fallout.
Plus, that will be combined with several earthquakes. We've already seen a few already. And why not sprinkle in this infestation of locusts that have been dormant for years and all of a sudden will attack mankind? So why not? Oh, then throw in Joe Biden trying to get into a war with Iran for whatever reason he wants to do that. So on that note, have a great weekend. We'll see you next week, or maybe not.
So, of course, you have confusion about some things, right? Like earthquakes happen. Eclipses follow a predictable pattern. We knew about this one for a while. There are no locusts. What Brian Glenn seems to be referring to is that there are cicada broods, and there's a 13-year life cycle brood and a 17-year life cycle brood, and they're overlapping this year. This happens every such number of years. And it always has to sort of push to, can we blame the left for anything? So he throws in a Biden geopolitical thing. And also, can we make some kind of reference to Bible scripture? And in this case, it's about locusts, because locusts are one of the plagues. Cicadas are not. But if you don't know the difference between locusts and cicadas, maybe it makes for some good fear mongering. And then as a bonus clip here, here is Rudy Giuliani also jumping in on this, saying that the earthquakes are God sending a message. It can't ever just be a probabilistic phenomenon where sometimes there are earthquakes and sometimes there are eclipses. It always has to be something. And here it is, a punishment from God for the communism of New York and California. Now, you might say, well, but California wasn't affected by this earthquake. No. But sometimes California does have earthquakes. So that's Rudy. Take a listen to this.
We left the communist state of New York. And then we were in the state of Connecticut. And we just escaped all of the earthquakes. And then we got to Massachusetts, which probably had some earthquakes. And we got to New Hampshire with no earthquakes, which is telling me that somebody's sending us a message.
Right.
Communist states are getting earthquakes. I think that's what look at California. You can't have more earthquakes than California.
Right. Famously, communistic California, which is the tech center, arguably, of the world. Famously communistic Massachusetts, which is a biotech hub for big pharma profits the world over. Famous communism, famously communistic Connecticut, filled with better tax circumstances for the wealthy New York business elite who choose to go to Connecticut rather than New York to save money on taxes. All famous elements and pinnacles and centers of communism. So it's what are the takeaways here? Obviously, Brian Glenn and Rudy Giuliani are not necessarily the people we want to be listening to. But it's this reminder that when everything when you have only hammers, everything looks like a nail. Biden foreign policy, bad.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those.
From New York, this is Democracy Now! I lost my children. I lost myself. How can this be Eid for me?
Palestinians in Gaza mark the end of Ramadan as Israel's six-month assault continues. We'll speak with two doctors just back from 2 weeks at the European hospital in Gaza who say we have never seen cruelty like Israel's genocide in Gaza.
My name is Feroz Sidwa. I'm a trauma surgeon in California. I left the Gaza Strip on Monday. Hopefully, we'll be going back soon to continue providing help to people who are still under assault, still being viciously attacked day in and day out, despite the UN calls for a ceasefire.
We'll go to Utah and North Carolina to speak with the two surgeons. Then Republicans in Arizona block efforts to repeal a 160-year-old near-total abortion ban after the state Supreme Court revived the law first approved before Arizona was a state and before women could vote. We'll speak with Dr. Deshaun Taylor, head of Arizona's only black woman-operated abortion clinic, and reproductive justice activist Alejandra Pablos, who's faced deportation for her work. We'll also talk to Chris Love, part of a reproductive rights coalition to put a constitutional amendment on abortion on Arizona's November ballot.
The Arizona Abortion Access Act enshrines the fundamental right to abortion in the Arizona state constitution, which is needed now more than ever, given that the Arizona Supreme Court recently upheld an abortion ban dating back to 1864 that bans all abortions and provides criminal penalties for anyone providing an abortion in the state.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As negotiations over a Gaza ceasefire continue in Cairo, Israeli forces killed three sons and four grandchildren of Hamas's political leader Ismail Haniyeh in an airstrike in central Gaza on Wednesday. Haniyeh spoke to Al Jazeera shortly after the attack.
They believe that if they kill or assassinate leaders or their next of kin, that we will abandon our people, that we will abandon our resistance. They are mistaken. This noble blood that is spilled, including my own children, will harden our resolve, make us more defiant, more adamant to continue to march on this road, the road of struggle and resistance until we win our freedom and the lawful rights of the Palestinian peoples are restored.
Ismail Haniyeh lives in Qatar. His sons and grandchildren were killed as they were reportedly traveling to a gathering to mark the end of Ramadan in Gaza. Across Gaza, Israel's six-month-long assault has cast a dark shadow on the holiday of Eid.
We haven't become accustomed to this life and we won't get used to it. We're just trying to. This Eid has come without any new clothes for the young ones, no money given to children and no joy. Those who have lost people, lost homes, what Eid is this? This is the Eid of destruction, not the Eid of joy.
In other news from Gaza, a UNICEF aid convoy was hit by Israeli gunfire today as it attempted to deliver life-saving supplies to children in northern Gaza. UNICEF said three rounds of gunfire hit the convoy. Israeli forces then refused to allow the aid convoy to head north, even though the UNICEF trip had been authorized. In related news, World Central Kitchen has revealed one of its aid workers was gravely injured last week in an Israeli airstrike on a mosque. The attack occurred just minutes before an Israeli drone repeatedly struck a World Central kitchen convoy, killing 7 aid workers in an attack that sparked worldwide condemnation. In other news from Gaza, a top U.S. official has acknowledged a majority, if not all, Palestinians are facing starvation in Gaza. David Satterfield, the U.S. humanitarian envoy in Gaza, made the remark during an online forum hosted by the American Jewish Committee.
There is an imminent risk of starvation for the majority, if not all, the 2.2 million population of Gaza. This is not a point in debate. It is an established fact which the United States, its experts, the international community, its experts assess and believe is real.
The top U.S. commander in the Middle East is heading to Israel today amidst growing fears Iran may soon launch an attack in retaliation for Israel's bombing of the Iranian consulate in Damascus last week. On Wednesday, President Biden said the U.S. commitment to Israel's security is ironclad. In Arizona, Republican lawmakers have blocked efforts by Democrats to repeal an 1864 law that bans nearly all abortions in Arizona. The move came a day after Arizona's Supreme Court revived the 160-year-old law, which was approved before Arizona was a state and before women could even vote. The court issued its decision a day after Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump said abortion should be decided by the states. On Wednesday, Trump criticized the Arizona ruling, saying the ban goes too far. We'll go to Arizona later in the broadcast. President Biden's hosting a trilateral summit today at the White House with Philippines President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida as the U.S. moves to expand its military presence around the South China Sea. Earlier today, protesters gathered in Manila to denounce the expanding U.S. presence in the Philippines.
We are being used as pawns by the Americans. They are bringing their military here through the 9 Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement bases, which they are planning to increase to 22. They are concentrating their machinery here, their bombs, aircraft, all focused on China. What does this mean? They will bring danger to the Philippines and make us a target.
In other news from the region, the U.S. has announced plans to expand a Navy base in Papua New Guinea, where China has also attempted to increase its footprint. In other news from Asia, South Korea's conservative prime minister and other top presidential aides offered to resign after the ruling People Power Party suffered a major defeat in parliamentary elections. Russia's continuing to attack critical parts of Ukraine's energy infrastructure by bombing a large electricity plant near Kyiv and several other power facilities. Following the strikes, the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, repeated his call for Western nations to provide Ukraine with more air defense. More than 110,000 people in Kazakhstan and Russia have been forced to flee their homes as the region faces its worst flooding in decades. Officials warn the flooding may worsen as the Ural River continues to rise from fast-melting snow and ice due to rising temperatures. In other climate news, scientists have revealed new heat records have been set in the ocean every day for the past year. March 2024 broke records for both air temperature and ocean surface temperatures. Ecuador's former vice president, Jorge Glass, has begun a hunger strike to protest his recent arrest on corruption charges. He was detained Friday when Ecuadorian security forces raided Mexico's embassy in Quito, where he'd been living since December. The Organization of American States and other international bodies have condemned the raid. Glass has denied the charges against him. The Environmental Protection Agency in the United States has for the first time placed limits on 6 types of PFAS chemicals in drinking water. The so-called forever chemicals have been linked to cancer, infertility, and thyroid problems. The EPA has also issued new rules aimed at reducing toxic emissions from more than 200 chemical plants. Many of the plants are located in low-income and communities of color in Texas and an area of Louisiana known as Cancer Alley. President Biden said Wednesday he's considering a request from Australia to drop the prosecution of WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange. Today marks 5 years since Assange was locked up in London's Belmarsh prison, facing extradition to the United States for publishing classified documents that exposed U.S. war crimes. Earlier today, Reporters Without Borders repeated its call for Assange to be immediately released. Go to democracynow.org to see all our interviews with Julian Assange and about him. The former chief financial officer of the Trump Organization, Alan Weisselberg, has been sentenced to 5 months in prison for lying under oath during Donald Trump's civil fraud trial. Meanwhile, another appellate judge has rejected Trump's latest attempt to delay the start of his own criminal hush money trial, which begins Monday. Independent presidential candidate Cornel West has tapped Melina Abdullah to be his running mate. Abdullah is a professor and a longtime organizer with the Black Lives Matter movement. Cornel West called her, quote, one of the great freedom fighters of her generation. In other election news, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has fired a staffer after she publicly said Kennedy is running as an independent presidential candidate in part to help Donald Trump win in November. Rita Palma, who served as Kennedy's New York State director, was recently filmed describing how President Biden could fail to reach the needed 270 electoral votes if Kennedy manages to win in a state like New York.
The Kennedy voter and the Trump voter, the enemy, our mutual enemy is Biden. Give those 28 electoral votes to Bobby rather than to Biden, thereby reducing Biden's 270. And we all know how that works, right? 270 wins the election. If you don't get to 270, if nobody gets to 270, then Congress picks the president. So who are they going to pick? Who are they going to pick if it's a Republican Congress? They'll pick Trump. So we're rid of Biden either way.
Police at Rutgers University have launched an investigation after an Islamic center at the school was vandalized on the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr. Vandals smashed windows, broke TVs, damaged artwork, and destroyed a Palestinian flag. Meanwhile, a Palestinian-American law student at the University of California, Berkeley, has accused a professor of assaulting her during a backyard dinner. A video of the incident shows law professor Catherine Fisk grabbing a microphone away from the student, Malaka Fena, as she attempted to speak out against Israel's war on Gaza.
Where millions of Muslims around the world fast, not only from the We have attorneys.
You don't have to get aggressive.
Please leave our house. You are guests at our house.
This is our First Amendment right.
No, this is my house.
National lawyers go.
The incident occurred during a backyard dinner hosted by UC Berkeley School of Law Dean Erwin Chemerinsky, who's married to Professor Catherine Fisk. In other academic news, the University of Cologne has rescinded a job offer to the Jewish-American philosopher Nancy Fraser because she signed a letter against Israel's assault on Gaza. Fraser, who teaches at the New School here in New York, said, quote, I was canceled in the name of German responsibility for the Holocaust. This responsibility should also apply to Jewish people. But in Germany, it's narrowed down to the state policy of the currently ruling Israeli government. Philo-Semitic McCarthyism sums it up quite well, a way to silence people under the pretext of supposedly supporting Jews, she said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll speak to two surgeons who've just returned from 2 weeks at the European hospital in Gaza. They say, we have never seen cruelty like Israel's genocide in Gaza. Stay with us. يا طالع عين عين للجبل يا مول للمقيدين النار بين لليمن يا مان عين للهنا يا روح ما بعتي منك لكم خلعة ولا لا 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 بدي زنار بين لليمن يا مان عين للهنا يا روح إلا بين لليمن يا مان عين للهنا Ya Tala'in, those going up the mountain, Palestinian folk song for prisoners adapted by Dana Salah. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. And a very happy early birthday to Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Gaza, where Palestinians mark the end of Ramadan as Israel's six-month assault continues. In a minute, we'll speak with two doctors just back from volunteering at the European Hospital in Gaza, who co-authored a new piece for Common Dreams headlined, "We have never seen cruelty like Israel's genocide in Gaza." In it, they wrote, quote, "As humanitarian trauma surgeons, we've both seen incredible suffering. Collectively, we were present at Ground Zero on 9/11, Hurricane Katrina, and the 2010 earthquake in Haiti on the first day of these disasters. We've worked in the deprivation of southern Zimbabwe and the horrors of the war in Ukraine, and attended primary trauma services to those injured in the Boston Marathon. Together, we've worked on more than 40 surgical missions in developing countries on three continents in our combined 57 years of volunteering. This long experience taught us that there was no greater pain as a humanitarian surgeon than being unable to provide needed care to a patient. But that was before coming to Gaza. Now we know the pain of being unable to properly treat a child who will slowly die, but also alone, because she's the only surviving member of an entire extended family. We have not had the heart to tell these children how their families died, burnt until they resembled blistered hot dogs more than human beings, shredded to pieces such that they can only be buried in mass graves, or simply entombed in their former apartment buildings to die slowly of asphyxia and sepsis."
For more, we're joined by the two surgeons who wrote that piece. In Rocky Mount, North Carolina, Dr. Mark Perlmutter is with us. He's an orthopedic hand surgery specialist who just returned Monday from volunteering at the European Hospital in Khan Yunis, Gaza. He worked with the Palestinian American Medical Association in collaboration with the World Health Organization. He's currently president of the World Surgical Foundation, immediate past president of the International College of Surgeons. And in Salt Lake City, Utah, we're joined by Dr. Feroz Sidwa, a trauma surgeon who's also just returned from European Hospital. He also worked with the Palestinian American Medical Association in collaboration with the World Health Organization. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! I mean, those words that you wrote in this piece, and we thank you so much for joining us on the day after you finally both got back to the United States. I wanted to just read one more part from your piece and get Dr. Feroz Sidwa to respond. As you talked about European Hospital, you said, "We walked through the wards and immediately found evidence of horrifying violence deliberately directed at civilians and even children. A 3-year-old boy shot in the head, a 12-year-old girl shot through the chest, an ICU nurse shot through the abdomen, all by some of the best-trained marksmen in the world." Dr. Sidwa, describe your 2 weeks there in European Hospital and what this meant, how it compares to other work you've done around the world.
Sure. Thanks for having me. The things that struck me about working at Gaza European Hospital were, there were a few. One was the actual state of the hospital. The infrastructure of the hospital is completely overwhelmed because not only the massive casualties that it's receiving and also having to deal with the normal medical problems that this hugely displaced population has coming down from the north, but also the infrastructure is just completely overwhelmed by this humongous displaced persons camp that's not only outside of the hospital but actually inside. It's every square inch of the hospital, the hallways, even the wards, is taken up with tents that people have constructed from the detritus of their house. So it's completely overwhelmed. Sanitation's impossible. Even basic cleanliness is impossible. The hospital is just barely hanging on by a thread in terms of functionality. And the other thing that was really causing the hospital major problems is that the staff themselves is extremely not only traumatized, but they haven't even been paid since October 7th. 100% of the staff are just working on a voluntary basis. And that's in the middle of still having to provide for their own family's safety, their own family's food provisions, sanitation, things that normally are just happening automatically. The medical students displaced from the north all came down and just spontaneously decided to volunteer at Gaza European Hospital. They're kind of running the emergency room as best they can, while other physicians have been displaced. Some of them have been killed. Some of them have been threatened by the Israelis and have left because of that. So it's a very difficult situation. The second thing that really struck me was the degree of violence that was being utilized. The magnitude of injury that's caused by the bombs that the U.S. bombs that Israel is using is really dramatic. These weapons are the blast effect is incredible. They throw the environment itself through these patients. I don't even just mean large pieces of shrapnel, like from the tile floor and the wall or whatever, being ripped up and thrown into people, which that happens too. But literally, the dust, the debris, everything is just embedded in the patient's skin. And again, it makes clean surgical operations just simply impossible. You'd have to rip the person's all of their skin off to sanitize anything. And then the third thing was the evidence, like you mentioned, that we wrote, the evidence of the directed violence specifically at children. I mean, you can maybe argue that a bomb went off and a kid just happened to be nearby, but it's not believable that the best trained marksman in the world accidentally shot a 3-year-old boy in the head, accidentally shot a 2-year-old girl twice in the head, accidentally shot, it just goes on and on. And that was, I knew about it before I went, but to see it in person, it was really pretty shocking. I think the last thing that I would say that struck me was the attempt of the Palestinians to maintain their dignity and their humanity, even in such really horrifying circumstances. They stayed in family units as much as they could. They tried to continue their traditions of Ramadan. Even though they're all desperately hungry and thirsty, they would still fast during the day. And it was the maintaining their culture, maintaining their family units, maintaining their belief that the future can be better. That was really quite dignified, in my opinion, and it was very, very impressive to see.
Dr. Mark Perlmutter, you and Dr. Sidva sent us a number of extremely graphic videos and photos, some of which we're showing for our television viewers. If you could explain why you think it's important for American audiences to see these graphic images, and then also explain why you, as an orthopedic hand surgery specialist, why you made the decision to go to Gaza.
Absolutely. First, happy birthday to you again. I'd like to echo what my newfound best friend Feroz had said. And realistically, what impressed me the most was the overt genocide that I was suspecting was going on. That's what brought me there. I was involved into a telehealth network providing advice to young orthopedic surgeons providing surgery in Gaza. And when I realized, based on direct feedback, that these very misplaced pins and screws were being performed by trainees without guidance because their attending orthopedic surgeons were killed or captured and imprisoned inside of Israel, and that they were flying without instruction, that I'd make a commitment to go. When I got there, echoing what Feroz had said, genocide was the overwhelming impression that I got. There are distinct signs of genocide. First of all, the bombs are cluster bombs. We've taken small pieces of shrapnel, dozens of pieces of shrapnel, out of toddlers, infants, and teenagers. The country's 50% children, if not more. Overwhelmingly, our victims were children. I would say 70 to 75% of the people that we operated on were elementary school age or younger. that the injuries were devastating, as Dr. Sidwa said, the world's best marksmen are not going to shoot a kid in the forehead twice and in the abdomen. These are midline shots directly aimed, and that doesn't happen by accident. Secondly, the bombing was concentrated at the time of evening prayers. It happened all day long, but it was distinctly, purposefully concentrated when the Muslims were gathered together in tight units, shoulder to shoulder, knee to knee, praying to God while they're being bombed. And the cluster bombs are infinitely more effective when the intended target is concentrated into a smaller location. That defines genocide. The cluster bombs are illegal. The snipers aimed distinctly at children are unethical and illegal. And then, of course, the way that you dehumanize a population is to kill the humans. You deprive them of their medical schools, their clinics, their ambulances. Sure, there was a big American and worldwide justified outcry when the World Central Kitchen vans were distinctly and purposely bombed right through the center of their hoods. But prior to that, 200 ambulances were targeted by the Red Cross. In this case, it's a Red Crescent, very prominently displayed on top of an ambulance. They have very modern ambulances. There is no mistaking that they were ambulances that were bombed. 200 were destroyed along with the paramedics. Doctors were distinctly shot. An orthopedic surgeon was shot in his knee while he's operating on a patient because the soldier commanded him to leave the operating room and he refused to abandon his patient quite ethically. He had his knee blown out across the room. He was immediately fixed by his trainees, and 2 days later, he was imprisoned by Israel for 45 days. According to him, a juice box every other day, blindfolded the entire time, dropped off at a non-road prison border to crawl for 3 kilometers until somebody rescued him. Blind in one eye because a rifle butt exploded his right eye. This is dehumanization. This is the purpose of this is to kill a population. Food delivery. When we left, there was tens of miles of incoming food trucks, 4 lanes. The entrance into Gaza and the exit road into Gaza were all lined on both shoulders of the road with tens of miles of food trucks parked bumper to bumper to bumper, trying to get into the country, of course, which is limited by the IDF or the Israeli government. Why aren't they letting the food in, if not for it to deprive the population of the substance that they need to survive? This is another definition of genocide. There's no reason why they can't let even inspected food trucks in. The product can be inspected. I'm sure it should be inspected. But this is life-sustaining materials. The hospitals, if we didn't bring our orthopedic implants, if we didn't bring our dressings, if we didn't bring medicines, they would be devoid of all of this. Another definition of genocide.
And Dr. Perlmutter, explain about the photos and the videos, why you think those are so important for American audiences to see, the ones that you and Dr. Sidwa sent.
Because the American public, and I'm sure the German public, the two societies that are most responsible for sustaining this genocide, their media is being sterilized. If they saw pictures of babies with 10 pieces of shrapnel in their in its 1-year-old forehead and throughout its face, if they saw a 12-year-old missing all of their limbs and burnt, like we said in our letter, like an ignored hot dog on a grill. If they actually saw the dehumanization, the degree of it, the ubiquitous, widespread nature of it, then they would open their eyes and realize that we're responsible for this. The big reason why I went is mea culpa. My tax dollars are paying for the bombs that are killing children, and that's horrible. You know, if we have a lot of school shootings in the United States, if a gunman goes into a school and starts killing children, the American response, the world-given response is a sniper team goes in and tries to take out the offending gunman, regardless of their age. The Israeli response is to drop a bomb on the school to kill the gunman, but also incinerate the hundreds and hundreds of children, perhaps thousands that could be living in that school, and incinerate them all just to get the single gunman. What America doesn't understand is that the Hamas soldiers comprise less than 0.1% of the population of Palestine, of Gaza. The analogy of killing innocent children in a school just to kill the single gunman holds. If an orphanage had an infected rat sneak into it, you don't incinerate the entire orphanage to get rid of the rat that snuck into the orphanage. But that's exactly what we're doing, except that we're giving the bombs to Israel to bomb the orphanage. We're buying the bullets and the gun for the gunman who's going into the school and killing innocent children. We're responsible, and we have to open our eyes as a society and realize that it's not just seven aid workers that unfortunately died, but there were 18,000 children that are shredded like paper. They just don't happen to be white children. And we have to open our eyes and care about them as much as we care about the seven aid workers that very unfortunately died.
I want to ask both of you a question, starting with Dr. Perlmutter. I mean, your credentials, you are an orthopedic surgeon, you are head of the World Surgical Foundation, past president of the International College of Surgeons. You're both American. Dr. Perlmutter, you're from a Jewish American family. Your twin is an Orthodox Jewish woman. Dr. Feroz Sidwa is Rastrian. I wanted to ask you, Dr. Perlmutter, you wrote two emails to the U.S. Embassy in Israel when you went, pleading with them not to attack European Gaza hospitals, saying we're deathly afraid of being bombed again, as we were this morning. What happened to you? And did the U.S. Embassy respond to you?
I sent them two letters. One when the bombs were shaking and they were shaking the fillings out of our teeth. It is as if lightning struck inches away from you. That's how much vibration the hospital ground sustained. Bombs did not actually enter into the walls of the hospital. They completely surrounded the hospital. The entire event occurred specifically to destroy the population outside the hospital. We were in fear of our lives. We were particularly in fear of our lives right after the bombing of the UN, the World Central Kitchen convoy, while we're in full knowledge that doctors were being kidnapped and targeted, almost 100 journalists were killed, destruction of multiple ambulances. We felt targeted from the beginning. So as we're approaching the end of our trip, and after we've heard that all other hospitals were being thoroughly destroyed and their surgeons being kidnapped, we were in fear of our own lives. More importantly, we're in fear of the tens of thousands of people that sought refuge in that hospital compound, hoping that a hospital would not be targeted. And so I wrote the American Embassy to both the Jerusalem and Tel Aviv offices. They sent me a return email acknowledging receipt of my first email. I've received no response from them. I've got acknowledgement from the first email that I sent. I sent a second email saying, this is the day we're leaving. Could you please inform the IDF that our convoy, just like the World Central Kitchen's convoy, is leaving at this time on this date. This is the vans, this is what the vans look like. This is the timing that we're going to leave. And I received no response from them as well.
You are talking to us from the hospital. You're in your scrubs in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. And Dr. Feroz Sidwa, you're in Salt Lake City on your way back to Stockton, California, where you work. I'm looking at your piece again in Common Dreams, Dr. Sidwa. You write, no amount of medical care could ever compensate for the damage being inflicted here. Israel's dropped so much American ordnance on Gaza that it now exceeds the explosive force of the atomic bomb that destroyed Hiroshima. Can you talk about what you would say if you got to speak to President Biden? We interviewed Dr. Thayer Ahmed, who had just returned from Gaza. We believe he's the first doctor on the ground in Gaza to actually directly address the president. He handed him a letter from an 8-year-old Palestinian orphan. and then walked out of the White House. He said, what can be said about what is happening here right now is the day after the attack on the World Central Kitchen. What is your message, and not only to the president, but around the world, Dr. Sidwa?
I don't think I would say much to Joe Biden. I think he knows exactly what's going on, and I don't think it's important to him. I don't think he cares if Palestinians are murdered like roaches and ants. But to the rest of Americans who have normal human values, they do care. And, you know, one of the other things that Mark and I wrote in that piece is that the blood on the trauma bay floor and the operating room floor was dripping from our hands. And I think that's accurate. We provide the crucial military, economic, and diplomatic support. Your viewers are no surprise to that. And that makes us responsible. If our support stops, the attacks stop. If our support stops, the occupation stops. It's instant. It's been proven 100 times. It's not hard to see. And so that's what I would say to people is if you want to stop participating unwittingly in some of the worst crimes that I've ever seen in my life, then you need to organize and you need to raise the cost to people like Joe Biden, because that is the only thing they care about. The U.S. is attempting to manage the Middle East with the system that I put in place since the Arab Spring, and the Palestinians are just kind of an annoyance to that system. They don't want to, the U.S. doesn't want Saudi Arabia to get, to have its ruling family shaken, the Jordanian ruling family shaken. But we have to raise the domestic cost for these policies, which, like Mark said, are really genuinely genocidal in nature. That they're it's dramatic. So I would say to people that you know what's going on, so stop thinking about it all that much and just start acting. Go to your houses of worship. Go to your community centers. Go wherever it is that you go and talk to people and say, look, let's go talk to our congressman in person. Let's demand a meeting. If you're a veteran, put your uniform on and go. I've had several veterans reach out to me. Put your uniform on. Go talk to your congressperson. Film it. Put it online. Do anything you can to embarrass these people and to make it obvious to the world that they are not acting with normal human decency in mind. They're acting with purely cold, almost mafia-like political calculations. And the only way that we are going to stop this is by raising the cost to them of doing so. That's what I would say to people, I think.
Well, Dr. Sidwa, of course, the continued justification for Israel's assault is the fact that they're targeting Hamas militants. You treated, we've just heard from both of you about the number of children you treated, mostly, as you said, elementary school children or below the age of elementary school. You dealt with numerous mass casualty events while you were at the European hospital in Khan Yunus. How many military age males did you treat?
I can count them on one hand. I think it was probably 4 or 5. And not one of them, they're like Mark said, the people who are actually in Hamas or the other Palestinian militant organizations is an extremely small number, even of military age men in the Gaza Strip. But we treated a handful, five at the very most that I can remember, military age men while we were there for any injury at all. The overwhelming consensus in the hospital was that if militants were to come in, they would actually come in with their, I don't know the technical terms, but with their unit and with their commander, and they would be spirited away from the hospital as soon as they were well enough to be taken out of the hospital. That never happened once to anybody. So I seriously doubt that I encountered a single combatant while I was there. It was a 100% civilian. I think the people I cared for were 100% civilians, even including the military age men that I took care of.
Finally, Dr. Perlmutter, if you could say, you know, what you think the medical needs there are now. I mean, there are no fully functional hospitals left at all. You've said that you could operate 12 hours a day, 7 days a week for years, and not make a dent because the needs are so great. So what can be done for people in Gaza suffering in this way as this war goes on?
Right. Two points. First, I've seen more orthopedic injuries in my 2 weeks there than I have seen in my entire 30-plus years of practicing and the additional 10 years of training before that. If I operated 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, it would take me 20 years for me to make a notable dent, a minuscule dent in the amount of orthopedic alone pathology that's there. The extent of damage, of carnage, is that widespread. In order to make a difference, it's not by supplying supplies, it's by eliminating the genocide. It's eliminating, it's imposing controls on Israel. It's by reaching out, as Dr. Sidwa said, to our senators. That letter that you read, I sent a copy of that to every single sitting U.S. senator. I called Chuck Schumer's office from Gaza while I'm being bombed and spoke to his secretary and said the noises in the background are American bombs being dropped by American warplanes, gifted essentially to Israel. And I'm in fear that they're going to kill me. I'm in bigger fear that it's going to keep me up all night with another dozen shredded children and women. As Dr. Sidwa said, I don't think I saw one person who would qualify as a military combatant. The victims were civilian, virtually 100%. I would echo his plea to please contact your state senator and House of Representatives and the federal ones as well. Share with them the knowledge that the sterilized history that they've been receiving and the sterilized facts that they have been receiving are in fact inaccurate, that there's true bloodshed that's going on at our hands that we're paying for. And they need to wake up and realize that it's not the payoff from the Israeli Political Action Committee that really matters to keep their jobs moving forward and their re-election occurring. What really should matter is the ethical basis of what they're charged to do, and that's to maintain the viability of the United States' image and our leader as a democratic nation supporting perfect ideals and not advancing their own personal agenda by supporting a state that's recklessly killing innocent women and children, something that every American should stand against.
Dr. Mark Perlmutter, we want to thank you so much for joining us, orthopedics hand surgery specialist, president of the World Surgical Foundation, immediate past president of the International College of Surgeons, speaking to us from now, his hospital on Rocky Mount, North Carolina, in his scrubs. And Dr. Feroz Sidwa, trauma surgeon, speaking to us from Salt Lake City, heading back to Stockton, California, where he works. They just returned Monday from volunteering at the European Hospital in Khan Yunis, Gaza. We'll link to the piece they co-authored in Common Dreams, We Have Never Seen Cruelty Like Israel's Genocide in Gaza. When we come back, we go to Arizona for an update on how Republicans blocked efforts to repeal a 160-year-old near-total abortion ban. Back in 20 seconds.
Was given to me, and every page spelled liberty. All my trials, Lord, soon be over. There is a change.
My Trials by Bedouin. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to the swing state of Arizona, where Republican lawmakers have blocked efforts by Democrats to repeal an 1864 law that bans nearly all abortions in the state. The move came a day after Arizona's Supreme Court revived the 160-year-old law approved before Arizona was a state and before women could even vote. Vice President Kamala Harris is on a Fight for Reproductive Freedoms tour that will visit Tucson on Friday. The court issued its decision a day after Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump said abortion should be decided by the states. Trump said Wednesday the Arizona ruling went too far.
We're joined now by Chris Love, spokesperson for Arizona for Abortion Access, a coalition working to put a state constitutional amendment on abortion on Arizona's November ballot. In Tucson, Alejandra Pablos is with us, reproductive justice community organizer who was targeted by ICE for her activism and faced deportation proceedings for over a decade. And in Phoenix, Arizona, we're joined by Dr. Deshaun Taylor, OBGYN physician, abortion provider, CEO of the nonprofit Desert Star Institute for Family Planning in Phoenix, Arizona, the only Black woman-operated abortion clinic in Arizona. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Dr. Deshaun Taylor, let's begin with you. You're a physician. The Arizona State Supreme Court, five of its seven justices chosen by the previous Republican governor, Ducey, have just reverted Arizona to this 160-year-old law that was put in place before women could vote, before Arizona was a state. And it says not rape, not incest, only the life of a mother or the death of a mother, the imminent death of a mother, could lead to a woman, could lead to the possibility of doing an abortion. What does this mean for you practically today? It hasn't been put into effect for, 14 days, and we'll see what happens. But yesterday we saw what happened in the state legislature. They simply adjourned before doing anything.
Basically, what this means is that people will not get their needed abortions in the state of Arizona. These laws carry prison time. And I, as an abortion provider, appreciate the words of our governor and our attorney general. But at the end of the day, someone has to test whether what they say they're going to do is true. So these lawmakers understand that the threatening us with prison time is very compelling and has a chilling effect. And so essentially abortions likely will not happen in Arizona because of those criminal penalties assigned to them, as we see going on across the country.
And Dr. Taylor, just to clarify, according to a survey for the Society of Family Planning, about 1,100 abortions take place every month in Arizona. Where will women go now to seek abortions?
What I want your viewers to understand is it was challenging for people to get abortions even prior to Roe v. Wade being overturned due to the web of restrictions, nearly 40 restrictions on the books in this state. And so people are already increasingly self-managing their abortions. People are already leaving our state who had the resources to do so. But the overwhelming majority of people who don't get their abortions have babies or become ill and potentially lose their lives. So what we see is these escalating things happening to our population, which are forcing people to take matters into their own hands, number one, or stay pregnant, because most people don't have the resources to leave the state for an abortion.
I wanted to bring Chris Love into this conversation. Even before the Supreme Court ruled, the state Supreme Court ruled, this coalition had formed and has been gathering signatures for a November referendum, a constitutional amendment that would guarantee the right to abortion, Arizona for Abortion Access, it's called. You have, what, 500,000 signatures? Isn't that ready to go? What are you waiting for at this point? Are you concerned that it still wouldn't get on the ballot?
So at this point, we're 3 months out from having to turn in all of our qualifying signatures. We have to turn in 384,000 valid signatures by July 3rd of this year. In Arizona, we collect far more signatures than we need because those signatures are easily challenged in our courts and sometimes thrown out. So we're aiming to collect more than double the amount to ensure that we are on the ballot in November. And, you know, I am very confident that we will be. We've seen a groundswell of, you know, Arizona voters who really understand that decisions about abortion should remain between a pregnant person and their medical provider and their family members if they so choose. But politicians, and especially now activist judges, have no role in that decision.
I wanted to ask Alejandra Pablos, an Arizona reproductive justice activist, does this ruling affect communities of color differently? If you can explain that. You yourself have been targeted for deportation as reproductive justice activists for a decade. But what does this particularly mean?
Thank you, Amy. Really good to be back amongst comrades that are doing great work in Arizona. Like you said, as an organizer, as somebody who's been sharing their story of being incarcerated, of being facing deportation, of having an abortion as a form of resistance, because we know where we are living and where we have been living way before Roe, the fact is that it was never enough for me and the organizing that we do as a person who's been criminalized, surveilled, right, for how I look, how I speak. We live in a country where the president doesn't, he can't even say the word abortion, right? So really, the people that are still making decisions for us don't look like us, right? So, but people like myself that have been organizing for reproductive rights, fighting stigma, right? We know what we want, and we want people to have the care that they need. We know that there are so many reasons why people do not want to parent, and reproductive justice is about, you know, supporting folks who want to parent, who do not want to bear children, right? And when we do want to parent, to do it in safe and sustainable communities. Like you said, I've been facing deportation, and sometimes I feel like that's already a choice that's been taken from me, right? Because who wants to parent under this stress? And the truth is that most people of color, migrant people, young people, trans, non-binary people who have abortion and need this reproductive health care have been, right, taken this choice away from them. We don't have the resources. We've been crying out to defund the police because it is a cry to fund our communities. We are creating constantly, lawmakers are creating desperate communities, right? We're going to be forcing people to have abortions and then blaming it on us, right? And fighting stigma right now for myself is where I want to focus my energy. I think as I created a project called Abortion Showers Project, where it is led by trans people, non-binary people, people from the Americas, right? That we understand it's our responsibility to fight and to talk about abortion of care in a loving way, because we've been taking care of each other for so long. So I think that's kind of some of the work I'm focusing on right now, because again, talking about this issue in Spanish, right? The United States is made up of non-white, non-English speaking people, right? So I think that's one way that I'm really fighting to really like love on our people in this moment where there's so much violence in Arizona. So our work right now really is to keep fighting stigma, right? To keep on sharing and fighting for education that's real, that's centered in real stories. And the plain and simple matter is that there's so much racism. It is a racial justice issue, right? Who are we trying to force to have abortions? Deshaun talked about prison. We already have the highest incarceration rates in the world in Arizona. And are we going to be filling it up with pregnant people? Or is that the only place we're going to force people to have abortions, right? It's just a really, really scary moment right now.
Well, Dr. Taylor, just to put this antediluvian ruling in context, in France, just earlier this year on International Women's Day, they actually enshrined abortion rights in their constitution. So if you could say, what steps now are doctors going to take, abortion providers like yourself, to reassure women who come to you And also, in the future, how are you organizing? What are you planning to do?
Right now, we are going to continue to provide abortions until we are made to stop. So that's the first thing. The second piece of this is Desert Star is an independent abortion clinic. And independent abortion clinics are closing at alarming rates across the country. And we know that when an independent abortion clinic closes, then it's gone. We don't have resources and infrastructure to sustain and withstand these political attacks on abortion. Thankfully, Desert Star in Arizona is now a nonprofit. And so I am confident our board of directors are committed to keeping the doors open so that once the pendulum swings back and we would be able to provide abortion again, that we will be able to do so because we still have all of the licenses, all of the protocols, and all of the things required to provide. But in the interim, we are also a provider of gender-affirming hormone therapy for transgender adults. We provide well exams, pap smears, we provide birth control, and all of those other things. So we have the opportunity to continue to provide services and then pivot into a community resource to assist abortion seekers in some way to get the needed abortions. And that is something that we're in progress with. And each individual provider will need to seek legal counsel and determine what level of risk that they are willing to assume to continue to help people in Arizona who need abortions.
Very quickly, Dr. Taylor, the Attorney General of Arizona, Chris Mays, said she will not enforce this 160-year-old law, saying, quote, no woman or doctor will be prosecuted under this draconian law. No woman or doctor will be prosecuted, she said, and also is appealing to attorney generals of the surrounding states to get women over the border or people who are pregnant over the border to places where they will be safe, like in Colorado. Do you think you're going to have to, if this remains, close down your clinic? And are you willing to go to jail? Like, what does it mean to say only in the case of the life of the mother? In Texas, a woman is suing because she kept going to the doctor, wanted to have a baby desperately. The fetus died in her, and they said she wasn't septic enough and now probably can never have a child again because of what she experienced.
So I said this before, and I will say it again. I did not go to medical school to go to prison. Therefore, I am not interested in being martyred in this scenario. I should not be in this scenario. We should not have these lawmakers making these types of laws that put my freedom in jeopardy just for providing the services and using the skills that I have honed over 23 years of my adult life. So I am, with my sleeves rolled up, deeply involved in community organizing and strategizing with people like Alejandra, where we will make sure that people get what they need. Otherwise, I have to go on the record, because what we do know is the people who are criminalized look like me. So if anybody's going to challenge this law, it is not a physician that looks like me. And I think that because I am 2% of the physician workforce in the United States as a Black woman, Black people need me to stay free, and the other people that I care for who are people of color and people who speak different languages need the caring care that I provide and what I am committed to provide in the community that I serve, which is medically underserved, ethnically diverse, socioeconomically depressed, and they deserve just dignified and qualified care by a provider who looks like them, speaks their language, and cares for them in a way that makes them feel seen, heard, and well cared for. I will say that
I'm going to interrupt one second because I want to give Chris Love the last word, and we just have 30 seconds. You want to get to a million signatures. How are you going to do that at this point? What has the response been since yesterday?
Well, we've obviously had a groundswell of support from Arizona voters who are mad as hell that this has happened. Obviously, our signature numbers are up. We'll be collecting signatures through the weekend. Our fundraising efforts are up. I think Arizona voters truly believe that our judges have gone too far and they need to have the say of that.
I want to thank you all for being with us. Chris Love of Arizona for Abortion Access, Alejandra Pablos, Arizona reproductive justice activist, and Dr. Deshaun Taylor, OBGYN physician. She is head of Desert Star Institute for Family Planning in Phoenix. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
Ready?
Hello there, everybody. I am Mando Richard. I can't even say my own name. I am Mando Richard, and I welcome you to another episode of Whiskey Before Breakfast Radio. We've got lots of good stuff lined up for today. The liquored up set at the beginning, the gospel set at the end, and lots of stuff old and new in between. So I know you're going to enjoy today's show. You know, I think we're going to go ahead and just get things started, shall we? Here comes Jontavious Willis with his song, Liquor.
Well, you drink in the morning, you know you drink at night. The way you drink, and I know you ain't feeling right. I said, 'cause you drink so much, baby. You're the low-down dirty shape. And the way you swallow that bottle, lift out to be your middle name. You got whiskey on your floor, gin in your trunk. At 2 o'clock in the morning and you already drunk. I said, you drink so much, baby. It's a low-down dirty shame. And the way you swallow that bottle, look ought to be your middle name. Thank you. you know you drank. Drink all the time. I know now, baby, you messed up all in mine. I said, you drank so much, baby. It's a low-down shame. And the way you swallow that bottle, look, gonna be your little name. And the way you swallow that bottle, look, gonna be your middle name.